What I'm going to do today in this beautiful setting is try to talk to you a little bit about the changing demography of the United States, how that changing demography, which is largely driven by the growth in the Latino population, intersects with issues of economic inequality, and why it's imperative that we begin to engage all communities in a struggle for justice moving forward. So that's where we'll be headed today. I always like to say, right before I get started talking, that while I'm speaking, my voice might break a little bit. It's not that I'm emotional being with you, although what could be a more glorious moment than being with the Latino ministry, right? Or like starting this session with salsa dancing to David. I mean, come on, that's really cool. It's actually that I've got a voice disorder that's called spasmodic dysphonia. It's the thing that Diane Rehm on NPR has, and now me, so I'm almost as famous as her. And I always like to reassure audiences that it's not to worry. It gets treated once a month with Botox. Because that's how we treat everything in Los Angeles. So it works. So for some of you, the happiest day of the year might be your birthday. It might be Christmas or Easter, reaching out to our sisters and brothers in other faiths. It might be the end of Ramadan, Hanukkah, etc. For someone like me, the happiest day of the year is the day the census releases its statistics. So it's a pretty godlike moment, actually. And let's see, this is not quite working. So if I go like this, move the slide, okay? So this is what the census sort of told us the last time that it came out in 2010. And you're going to notice as we go through this, some of the things have washed out a little bit with this projection system. But the important thing is that in the last census, the growth rate for Latinos was 43% in a decade. The growth rate for Asian Pacific Islanders, 43%. Remarkable coincidence. I think they were coordinating. The growth rate for African Americans, 11%. And the growth rate for non-Hispanic whites in the United States was only 1%. So that's a pretty big difference, 43%, 1%. And so people like me were not as surprised as some of the newscasters were on the evening in November 2012 when Barack Obama won re-election with only 39% of the white vote. You may remember they were going, oh my God, the country's changed, the country's changed. People like me were going, where were you for the last 2 years when I kept saying, the country's changed, the country's changed. And what's interesting about that change is that when in particular people see the sharp growth rates for Latinos and Asian Pacific Islanders, 43%, most people in the United States think, what is driving that? What do most people think is driving that? Immigration. And that answer is wrong. Immigration into the United States has slowed down for the last 4 to 5 years. It's really stabilized. Net migration from Mexico, our largest sending country, has been zero for the last 3 years. There's as many Mexicans going back to Mexico as coming into the United States. Why? The Mexican economy has been doing better, but more fundamentally, and there's much better enforcement actually at the border, but more fundamentally, birth rates have changed. It used to be over the course of her lifetime, a Mexican woman 35, 40 years ago would have at least 5 children. Now the fertility rate in Mexico is 2.3. The fertility rate in the United States is 1.7. As those two come together, there's less of a long-term push factor, less migration. In fact, if you think about it, and of course last summer no one did, the reason why, in part, we had a crisis of the unaccompanied minors from Central America at the border was that the coyotes, the human traffickers, were trying to drum up business because they weren't getting enough business from Mexicans, right? So in that context, right, what's really driving the growth, and you'll see it in just a minute, is not immigration any longer, but children. The children who are being born of immigrants and the children who are being born of the native born in the United States. So what does that mean moving forward? If you look at this graph, what it means now is that this demographic change is projected such that by the year 2043, 2044, we're projected to become a so-called majority-minority country, or as I like to think of it, all minority all the time. That is, every group will be a minority. But the more interesting statistic, actually, is that 10 years before that, around 2031, 2032, the majority of the workforce will be people of color. I did not say, by the way, the majority of entrants into the workforce. I said the majority of the workforce. That is, the older folks will be whiter, people will be working, people of color. Sometime before the end of this decade, the majority of youth will be people of color. So these are big, dramatic changes, and you can see the youth component right here. So in the last 10 years, and this clicker now seems to be working, in the last 10 years, the number of young white people in the country actually fell by 4.3 million. Now, that does not mean that 4.3 million young white people died. We would have noticed that. It would have been reported on Fox News. And it would have been blamed on Obamacare. I mean, you know that's the truth, right? So even if you're a big fan of Sean Hannity, you know that's the case, right? And by the way, if you're wondering if I'll make fun of MSNBC later, nobody watches them, so what's the point? So one person, okay. So what it means, really, is that there's more people moving into 19 and 20 that are moving into 1 and 2, so the net number of young whites has fallen by 4.3 million. Number of young African Americans fell slightly by 250,000. Some of that's redesignation into the multiracial category, but not as much as people think. The number of young Latinos in the country grew by 4.8 million. The number of young Asian Pacific Islanders by 800,000. That's the next America. And if you think about that next America, you could see sort of what's projected in the future in terms of the change in the U.S. male population. Looking at it a little bit more, you could see that most of the gain in the young male population moving forward over the next sort of 30 years is projected to be Latino. And then moving back to this, I want to point out something very important. So this is that same chart you were taking a look at for the United States. And look at these numbers from 2000 to 2040. 2000, the United States was 69% non-Hispanic white. It's projected by 2040 to be about half non-Hispanic white. That's basically what California went through between 1980 and 2000. Between 1980 and 2000, California's demographic change is what America's demographic change is going to be for the next 40 years. California, and I know if you're not from there, you don't like to hear this, is America fast forward. And if you're from there, you just applaud it. So the thing about this that's kind of interesting, a couple things. One is that those were really bumpy years for race relations in California. They were years in which we had fights over immigration with Prop 187, fights around affirmative action, the LA civil unrest, et cetera. But we're sort of coming to the end of that. We just got licenses for undocumented immigrants. We just passed the California Trust Act, which is that our local authorities will not cooperate with immigration and customs enforcement. We seem to be moving into an era where we're moving a bit past that, and so there's an interesting future here. Second thing that's interesting about this is that You know how demographers say, like, the 300th millionth baby was born today? His name is Jose. He lives in Raleigh. You're like, how did you know that, right? So there was an exact day, December 15th, 1999, when some demographer said California had become majority-minority. And I kept getting phone calls from reporters all day long saying, we're majority-minority, we're majority-minority, we're majority-minority. What's it mean? What's it mean? What's it mean? A tone of anxiety in their voice. So finally, like any honest academic, I gave them the right answer. I said, I don't know. But we're having a salsa party at my house tonight to celebrate. In the spirit of the new California, everyone's invited. They just need to learn a new step. And that's part of what we're all doing with this ministry, with educating your church more broadly, with sort of moving America to learning a new step about what's it mean to lead in a nation which is changing. And the interesting thing is, again, what people imagine about California is because California, if we go back, let's see how this works. Yeah, if you go back, you could see that trend going on like this. And so what people imagine is, you know, if you look at that trend, it was like for a while, there's a big, growth in Latinos. And in fact, it makes sense. 25% of immigrants into the United States came through Los Angeles County in the 1980s, right? We were ground zero for that change. And so what people imagine is that that change is just going to keep on going the same way, right? That eventually California will be 150% Latino. People will have to say California the right way, right? And Carolina, no es muy lejos tampoco. So, but what you can imagine is that, or see, is that that change is actually sort of settling out in California. We're sort of coming to an end of a demographic process, not the beginning. And interestingly, what's no longer driving our change is immigration. In fact, in Los Angeles County, where I live, the share of immigrants has been falling for the last 4 years. In California, the share of immigrants, the share of foreign-born, been falling for the last two or three. We're a much more native-born, Latino and Asian, but native-born population. Where it is growing is the rest of the country, and you'll be able to... And we also have, I should mention, a much more settled immigrant population. So these are the states of the United States arrayed by the percent of immigrants who've been in the country since 1999. 72% of our immigrants in California have been in the country since 1999. In fact, 55% or so of our undocumented immigrants have been in the country for more than 10 years. Deeply settled into the fabric of California. If you're wondering, the state with the second most settled immigrants is Vermont. And that's because they have like two immigrants, right? And they've been there a really long time. So, and if you're from Vermont, try to learn to take a joke. Come on. But what's fascinating is that now this growth is actually occurring all over the country. So, you know, if you look at the states by the percent Latino, so New Mexico, Texas, California, Arizona, the states you would think. But what's fascinating to me is a state like Utah, which is now the 11th most Latino state in the United States. And as some of you know, attitudes there have been shifting. The Utah Compact, which was an agreement amongst civic leaders, business leaders, faith leaders, to at least have a civil conversation around immigration issues. Connecticut is now a heavily Latino state. Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and even Kansas. So this is happening all over the United States, and you can see this by looking at a series of maps. These are from a project that we've been doing with PolicyLink, which is an organization in Oakland. And this is a map of the United States in 1980. It's a very easy map to interpret. The browner the county, the browner the county. So higher share of people of color. So the United States in 1980 looked like people kind of still think it does. The Black Belt of the South going up to D.C., the Hispanic sort of borderlands of Texas with Mexico, the Hispanic and Native American areas of New Mexico and Arizona. But look at California. California only had one county that was majority people of color. That was Imperial County, right on the border with Mexico. Los Angeles had not crossed that threshold. Let's look at the United States in 1990. In 2000, and now in the most recent census. But now watch what happens over the next 30 years. 2020, 2030, 2040, just leave it there. So, a couple things. First, diversity is coming to a theater near you. All right, so this, what's interesting is it's not changing in California. It's going to change in the rest of the country. That's really important to know. The second thing is that where the diversity is not going to increase is either lightly populated areas or the industrial Midwest, which is not growing economically and so not attracting folks. And so it's actually no surprise that you're seeing cities like Cleveland and St. Louis launch welcoming initiatives to try to attract immigrants. And the other weird thing about this, which I just really want to highlight because I've been thinking a lot about this, you know, the president's executive action on immigrants, which is extending more of the deferred action for people who arrived as children, and then also trying to launch a program called DAPA, Deferred Action for Parents, for parents of children mostly, almost entirely born in the United States, called DAPA, who have to have also been here for longer than 5 years, not had a major scrape with the law. Here's an interesting fact. The 25 states, with the exception of Texas, that are suing the United States, Ben Obama about that, have very few immigrants. The 11 states that have the most immigrants have filed on behalf of Obama. The cities that have the most immigrants have filed on behalf of maintaining the executive action. And by the way, we released a report yesterday, and then I'll get off my high horse about this, about something people don't realize, which is interesting. So deferred action, DACA, it's called Deferred Action for Childhood Adjustments, right? So when you hear that, you think most of the people it will affect are what? Children, which is wrong. Because in particular, the extension of DACA right now, which is going to bring 300,000 new people in, 75% of those are because the age cap is being lifted, and so people older than 30 are going to be able to get DACA. Who are the children are going to be affected? The children of the parents. And it turns out there's 6.6 million children in the United States of DAPA parents. And here's the interesting statistic about that. 600,000 of them can vote right now because they're older than 18. And by the year 2020, 1.7 million of them can vote. And they might just remember what's happening right now. Just saying. Because sometimes political figures seem to think Latinos have amnesia, right? Like, you can say self-deport me, pero cuando viene la elección, right? I'm going to forget that, right? So, big change in the country. Big editorial comment by Pastor. And another interesting thing about this change is the way in which Latinos are trying to be fit into U.S. racial categories. So I want to talk a little bit about that. Because some of you know the census asks, they never asked about it. The first time they ever really asked about Latinos was in 1973. Now, that does not mean that Latinos did not exist before then. I know, I was one, right? But they didn't really ask about it until 1973. 1980 is the first year that they really asked the question in the census, are you Hispanic or non-Hispanic? But the way they did it in 1980 was they asked you first, Are you Hispanic? Or they asked you first, what race are you? White, black, Asian, Native American, other. Then they asked you whether you're Hispanic or non-Hispanic. And much to their surprise, what the census found was, if you go back, what they found was that, that number looks a little wrong there, but that 58% of Latinos, 38% of Latinos marked other. They didn't mark a race. And so the census in 1980 afterwards thought, well, geez, you know, it's the first time we did this. Maybe the Latinos were confused. In 1990, we'll just do it the same way. So in 1990, it did it the same way. And that year, in 1990, 43% of Latinos marked other. They refused to mark a racial category. So the census tried to figure out what was going on there. And they started to take a look at the individual answers in the census to see what people put down when they checked other. And people were like checking other and then writing, Chicano! With three exclamation points, right? So the census thought, well, you know what it is? Latinos need to get it out of their system. So they reversed the order of the question. So in 2000, they asked you first whether you're Hispanic or non-Hispanic. Then they asked you what race you were. And that year, more Latinos than other ever marked other. Last year, the number of Latinos marking last census, 2010, it went down. Now, here's why. People made a big deal about this. Okay, maybe Latinos are feeling more white. If you read the questions, now the questions read in bold, are you Hispanic or non-Hispanic? And in bold, it says below, right there, Hispanic is not a race. And then when it gets to the race question, it says, what race are you? And it says again in bold, Hispanic is not a race. And that year, despite being explicitly told not to, 44% of Latinos marked themselves as other. So someone like me might conclude that maybe the racial categories are wrong and that Latinos don't want to be fit into this kind of pigeonholing. This is not to say there's no racism in the Latino community, but it's also something where we hold many different colors and origins in our families, in our communities. And so it's something that needs to change in this. Another little interesting fact, we did a report or an article called Where in the World is Juan and What Color is He? And what we were trying to take a look at is whether when people move to suburbs, it makes them feel whiter. So we were trying to look at the answers on the census depending on where people live. And we did find out, by the way, suburbs whiten people, even controlling for income and everything else. But we found out something really interesting, which is most of the literature said that it turns out that most of the literature surmised that the Latinos marking other must be recent arrivals, and that the more time they spent in the United States, the more they would realize, oh, you know, I guess I'm white, or I guess I'm black, or whatever, right? That they would become used to the racial categories. Kind of, I mean, do you see why that might make sense? So we looked at that for the very first time, and what we found out was that the more time you spend in the United States, the less white you think you are. There's something about the U.S. that just knocks the whiteness right out of you, right? So there's a kind of othering that's going on, and I think that that's an important thing to consider. The other thing I think that's really important to consider, particularly for you doing these ministries, and I think most of you already know this because of where you're working, is that the place where diversity is now growing the most is actually in America's suburbs. The central cities are actually often whitening, gentrification, et cetera. And one of the most paradigmatic examples, this is Seattle in 1980, darker colors, more folks of color, mostly concentrated in 1980 in the central city. This is Seattle in 2010. That growth, I mean, basically the city is whitening, and it's the suburbs of Seattle that are getting a Latino population, an African immigrant population, et cetera. So that's where that demographic change is occurring. So this is important because when we often think about doing a ministry for people of color, we think of it as an urban ministry. But increasingly, it's a rural ministry and a suburban ministry as well. And these are a lot of the places that really don't have the infrastructure in place to do this. Does that make sense? Okay, next thing I wanted to kind of talk about with regard to the geography is something people really, I think, ought to pay a lot of attention to. And it's the relationship between African Americans and Latinos in our urban areas, because those turn out to be the two groups moving into the closest proximity and in ways that are asymmetric. So let me explain that. This is kind of close to where I live, South Central Los Angeles. South Los Angeles was in 1970 80% African American. South LA today is 2/3 Latino. Now, look at South LA in 1970, and then 1990, and then in 2010, that was the African American community. Now the Latino community, 1970, 1990, 2010. So big, dramatic changes. And what's fascinating about this, I think, is really important for that, really important in particular for Latino leaders to realize. This change is going on, but it's mostly Latinos moving into African American neighborhoods, not African Americans moving into Latino neighborhoods. Why that's important is because it means that African Americans are having to learn how to deal and make coalitions with Latinos around a number of issues, but not all Latinos are going through that experience. And so it's particularly important for Latino leaders to make folks aware of the situation of African Americans in the country. And one of the things that I think that we often do is we try to bring people to pay attention to issues of immigration in a transactional versus a transformational way. We say, oh gosh, I wonder how we can get African Americans to support on issues of immigration. Or African Americans will say, I wonder how Latinos can support on certain kind of issues important to them. Instead of taking a transformational approach, which means that for those of us working with Latinos, we need to work with immigrants to make them realize the centrality to the social justice story in the United States of the African American experience. If there was no Selma, if there was no Selma, there'd be no voting rights movement. If there were no voting rights movement, there wouldn't be Latino politicians. If there was not a civil rights movement, we would not have had the immigration reform that allowed so many of our hermanos and hermanas to be able to come to this country. African Americans are central to that struggle. Similarly, we found working with African Americans that, you know, almost all you need to do is get that book, Warmth of Other Suns. Anybody read that by Isabel Wilkerson about the Great Migration? I would encourage those of you who mostly work with Latinos to read that book, because what it's about is about the Great Migration from the South to the urban areas of the North. And my God, she's so good at about every 50 pages of going, seems like immigrants today. And what we found is that when people can see themselves in these stories, they can build these alliances. And this alliance between African Americans and Latinos is central to the future of social justice in the United States. One more slide. Board. So, has some of that been interesting? Okay. None of it is as interesting as this particular slide. This has to do with the age structure of the population. And for the United States as a whole, in 2010, the median age for non-Hispanic whites, median means half older, half younger, was 42 years. The median age for Asian Pacific Islanders, 35. The median age for African Americans, 32. For Native Americans, about the same. For Latinos, 27. 42, 27, 15 years. It's a generation gap. And it helps to explain two things. First, it helps to explain our demographic change. Because when you're 27, you're in prime family formation age. When you're 42, you think you're in prime family formation age. You may be. Godspeed. But it also helps to explain a sort of generational chasm in our politics. So here's an interesting question. What state do you think has the biggest generation gap, the whitest old, the brownest young? Any guess? California, Texas, Arizona. And think of the politics around immigration, ethnic studies in the schools. And then think about the following thing. In the last 5 years, Arizona had the third largest cuts in K through 12 education spending, had the largest percentage cuts in public university spending. There is a disconnect between an older generation and a younger generation, with an older generation not seeing itself in that younger generation and the investments not being made. And it is so important for faith communities to restore that generational connection, to make people realize that we are all part of one beloved community. And when we leave people behind, particularly the next generation, we are diminishing ourselves and our mission. How much more time do I have? Because I could preach, you know. No. About 10 minutes? Okay. So I want to just talk about, next slide. So what I do want to talk about a little bit, though, is this issue of inequality, and then I want to kind of come to a conclusion because I think the conversation will be more useful. There's been a tremendous attention paid to these issues of income inequality as well. Next slide. And one of the reasons why is because if you look at the share of income going to the top 1% in the country, it's now at the highest level it's been since the 1920s. In fact, there's sort of two peaks in that graph. One is 1928, right before the Great Depression, and the other is 2007, right before the Great Recession. And when you have this much inequality, you steer yourself into economic trouble, because you wind up creating a class so wealthy that it winds up speculating on crazier and crazier derivatives. You wind up having a group of folks so financially strained that they wind up borrowing to buy that one last house before the American dream disappears in them, or borrowing simply to stay alive. And you wind up creating a kind of financial turmoil that sunk our economy. And what's critical about this is that it's going to hurt us moving forward. So next slide. I'm going to jump over these. Next slide. And just tap it one more time. Great. So we have a lot of inequality, but the myth we tell ourselves, right, is that we're very unequal, but at least people get ahead over time. At least people get ahead over time. And the interesting thing is this is a chart looking at inequality along the horizontal axis, and there's a fancy name for this, intergenerational earnings elasticity, but I call it class stickiness, which is the likelihood if you're born in the bottom quintile that you'll wind up in your later life in the bottom quintile, or if you're born in the top quintile that you'll end up in your later life in the top quintile. So you'll note there's a pretty good relationship between inequality and class stickiness. The other thing you'll note is that there's only two countries that are less mobile than the United States. One is the United Kingdom, and they have a queen. And the other is Italy, and they have Silvio Berlusconi, which is kind of like having a queen, right? So and you'll see that one place that's more equal and more mobile is Canada. So if you want to pursue the American dream, go north, young man, go north. So I'm going to try to jump over a bunch of these right now so I can get to this message. Hit it one more time. Go back one. If you go back one slide, thanks. And then just let that maybe hit it again. Let's see what happens. Forward. Stop. Perfect. Stop. Okay, great. I know it's automated. So a lot of the ideas that I'm talking about, by the way, are in this book, which I'm understanding is being bought for all ministers in the Methodist Church. It's called Just Growth. And one of the things that's interesting is we've been taking a look at a lot of the evidence. And what we're finding is something that, I mean, if you think about it, it makes sense to you. And it actually makes sense and should make sense. You know, when something is really unequal, it doesn't work very well. I mean, when you organize your ministry, you don't organize it to privilege one group dramatically over another because you know that that won't make the whole function and the community do well. And what we've been finding is when you look at economies that are very unequal actually don't grow very sustainably over time. And it's not just us finding that. There's a recent study from the Cleveland Federal Reserve that found the same thing, and a recent study from the International Monetary Fund. And a lot of that is reviewed in this book, Just Growth, which, by the way, even if the church doesn't buy it, you can download it from Amazon. It's Kindle ready. And for those of you who are not readers, it's about to be made into a major motion picture in which I will be portrayed by Antonio Banderas. I am so excited about this. So, next slide, stop. So I want to tell you one reason why this is so critical right now. And what this is gets back to the demography. This is something called an age pyramid. And what an age pyramid is, it takes the percent of people at different age brackets, and normally it looks like a pyramid. There's a lot of people at the youthful, right? As you move kind of into older age, there's less and less till you get to the oldest ages, and there's very few of us who survive. What you're going to notice is that in 1950, do that again, in 1950, the United States actually had an age pyramid. A lot of people at the bottom, very few people at the top, moving to the middle. The brown bars moving through are the baby boomer generation. What you're going to notice is by the year 2060, we don't have a pyramid, we have a cylinder. That means there are going to be fewer children, more old people, and less immigrants filling in the middle. And what that means is that unless we deal with the issues of racial and income inequality now for our young people, we are not going to have a functioning economy and society in the future. And taking this essential lesson and preaching it in the world of economics and politics, in the world of faith communities, in the world of decision makers is absolutely crucial. Next slide. In order to move forward, then, we're going to need to build relationships, think about data, think about movements. I'm going to do just one of these and then come to a conclusion. So next slide. This is San Antonio, Texas. And just 2 years ago, San Antonio did something rather remarkable. The voters of San Antonio passed a sales tax on themselves to deliver pre-K education to the most disadvantaged kids in San Antonio. So that's remarkable because, you know, usually it's not the most disadvantaged to vote. But perhaps what's most remarkable about it is that it was supported by the mayor, to be sure, by community groups, but it was also supported by the San Antonio Chamber of Commerce, who saw this as a workforce development issue for 20 years in the future. By thinking about how rooted they were in San Antonio, what they needed to do to be able to move forward, they were able to get this consensus. And in a way, it's not a surprise, since as many of you know, San Antonio has also been the location of COPS, Communities Organized for Public Service, an interfaith organizing group, which has helped put together that kind of understanding between constituencies. That's a role the faith-based community can play. Next slide. Next slide. Next slide. So, I want to come to a conclusion. So one of the things I think that's crucial is to understand that these are lots of facts and data, and they do tell us where we're headed. Martin Luther King who we've been thinking about even more since the 50th anniversary of Selma, told us about the moral arc of the universe being long, but bending toward justice. The footnote many folks remind of doesn't bend on its own, right? It takes a lot of people to make it bend toward justice. And in doing that, we need to think about the way in which social movements play a role and the way in which leaders can play a role as well. That the way in which change happens is by creating movements that are deeply rooted not in interests, but in values. If you think about the generational disconnect I was talking about before, you could solve the problem for older folks by being on the course that we're right now, which is protecting Social Security and Medicare at all costs, not raising any kind of taxes to pay for what we need for young people, and creating sort of generational conflict. You can meet your interests that way. But you can meet your values of a whole society. If you want a good education for your kid, you can meet your interest by putting them in a private school. But you can't meet your value about how public education is crucial to the formation of citizenship and democracy in America. You can meet your interest of having your own life be secure and safe by moving to a neighborhood far from the challenges of the rest of the world. But you can't meet your value of wanting a whole, safe, and healed world by doing that. We can't get ahead simply by putting together people based on interests. We need to get ahead by putting together people based on values. And the role of the faith community in this is absolutely critical. Next slide, I hope it's the last slide. Move. So I want to end by talking a little bit about leadership and how this happens. And that gets me to close more or less on time. So before I went to USC, I worked at UC Santa Cruz, and we ran a summer institute for community organizers from Latin America and Latino communities in the United States. This was about 15 years ago, before transnationalism was totally hip. But we brought people together for 5 years who were organizers on both sides of the border to say, what were the needs, how could people communicate, et cetera. And at the end of one of those sessions, an organizer from Sinaloa, Mexico, said, you know, there's only two kind of leaders in this world, leaders who like the game of chess and leaders who like the jigsaw puzzle. And like you, we were looking at him going, what the heck are you talking about? And what he said, his name was Victor Quintana, was that in chess, there's only two colors, usually black and white. In the jigsaw puzzle, there's many different colors. And indeed, a single piece can be multi-hued. In chess, one piece is far more powerful than another. You're always bummed out when a pawn knocks over your queen. In the jigsaw puzzle, every piece is important because it's so frustrating to get to the end and find that you don't have that last piece. And you know it's your children who hit it. In chess, you literally move ahead by knocking another piece down, taking them off the field. In the jigsaw puzzle, you move ahead by fitting the pieces so together so seamlessly that you don't know where one ends and another begins. In chess, the object is to win. In the jigsaw puzzle, the object is to complete the tapestry. As a nation, we're playing way too much chess and not enough jigsaw puzzle. We are dividing people by immigration status. We are dividing people by race. We are dividing people by city and suburb, by faith communities, even by parties. And we need to contribute to weaving that tapestry that will make people realize their common and interwoven destiny. And your ministry is absolutely crucial at doing that, about bringing Latinos into the fold, but also making sure that that fold changes and becomes different and a richer and more beautiful jigsaw puzzle. Thank you.